Okay, well, welcome once again. This is Richard Clem coming to you today from Minnesota. We're going to be presenting a conference call looking at some recent decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals that have been handed down during July 2014. This is a follow-up from some earlier programs that I've done looking at some decisions, and we'll probably be continuing this in the future. We're coming to you live today on July 28th, 2014, as part of a telephone conference call, and we are also coming to you today as part of my on-demand podcast CLE program. And whether you're taking the program live today or if you're listening to the podcast, during the course of the program, I will be giving four code numbers, a letter and a number. Write down those four code numbers and email those to me at the end of the program, and that's how I take attendance, because that way that satisfies the reporting requirements for all the states that that I work with to make sure that you are here and I can keep a record of your attendance. So, like I say, please email those to me at the end of the program, and based upon that, I will send you out a certificate of attendance saying that you were here today. Well, like I say, just we're coming to you today live, July 28th, 2014, and just kind of a sidelight on that date, according to Wikipedia, anyway. And many other sources, today is the 100th anniversary of the start of the First World War. Although if you want to take a look on my blog, if you want to see some of the headlines from 100 years ago, I have a link to my blog on the course materials for the program. The as far as I can tell, the actual declaration of war was on July 26, 1914, 2 days ago. But if you want to take a look at some of those headlines, I don't know. I always kind of think of the start of World War One as kind of beginning of a new era, kind of a modern era. Everything was more in place, pretty much in place, that we think of as our society today about that time. So, kind of a remarkable time in history. So, so if you're interested in seeing more, you can see that on my blog. And as the history continues, my blog will probably be following up some more on some of the history. In particular, what I kind of look at on my blog is the history of radio and the history of radio regulation. And of course, that had a big impact on World War One. So if you're a history buff, you can take a look at that. But otherwise, we're going to move from 1914 to 2014. And like I say, we're going to be looking at some recent decisions handed down by the Minnesota courts. The first one I have here in my materials, as you see, I don't have a whole lot of summary in my materials, is the Bratz decision. Bratz versus Parsons Electric Company. It was a workers' compensation case decided about a week ago, July 23rd, by the Minnesota Supreme Court. And you know, on some of these, you kind of see that some of my course materials, I go into a little bit more detail with the summary of the case. And some of them, like this one, I just kind of copy the syllabus provided by the Minnesota Supreme Court. This one, I just kind of copied the syllabus because I think it's this is pretty much just a statutory construction kind of issue. I guess if you're dealing with workers' compensation and you're worried about collecting your attorney's fees, well, then it's certainly an important case from that point of view. But like I say, I think it pretty much is just a matter of construing the statute here. Minnesota workers' comp, there's a set attorney's fee that's kind of presumptively allowed, although if you if it's a more complex case, you might get higher fees, and those factors are listed in the Irwin case that is cited there. Basically, this court applied those Irwin factors and held that even though the amount of attorney's fees actually exceeded the amount of benefits, it was still proper. However, they did exclude part of the claimed attorney's fees because the attorney in the case had expended some of his hours on an issue that was ultimately not addressed in the proceeding. So those were disallowed. But otherwise, like I say, pretty much a statutory construction case and an application of the fees from that that Irwin case. The well, I guess the Supreme Court didn't hand down a lot of decisions this month because we jumped back to July 9th. I guess they skipped a week. The this Citizen State Bank versus Brown is certainly kind of an interesting case, and you kind of wonder what the backstory is on this case because. Kind of an interesting fact pattern, because Mr. Brown, who passed away during the pendency of the appeal, but he was 93 years old, and he had guaranteed some. I have a typo. I can't spell guarantee, but he guaranteed some loans for the that were made to a corporation. The corporation defaulted on those loans, and they went against him to collect under the guarantee, and apparently he had an investment account valued at about $1.2 million, and he had some significant assets, so they decided to go after him and collect on the guarantee, so they sued him. Well, during the pendency of that lawsuit, he filed for divorce. And like I say, he was 93 years old, and the divorce was filed, and they had been married about 25 years. So he was apparently 68 years old at the time of the marriage. Well, his wife at the time of this trial was 55 years old. So kind of, you know, I wonder what the backstory is on that. He was 68. She was 30. They were married, presumably happily married for 25 years. But well, just didn't last. He was 93. She was 55. They filed for divorce. But apparently, it was an amicable divorce, or maybe even the divorce had something to do with this pending lawsuit. But a marital termination agreement was made between the two parties, and basically the wife got everything. So she got the $1.2 million. So the bank successfully brought this lawsuit to enforce the guarantee, and they had this judgment against Mr. Brown, and they went to collect on that judgment. And he said, "Well, I'm judgment proof. I'm just a penniless old man." They said, "Well, we thought you had $1.2 million." And he said, "Well, my ex-wife got it all. She got it in the divorce. So he didn't have any assets." Well, the bank apparently wasn't quite so satisfied with that. So they brought an action against her as well, saying that this was a fraudulent transfer. And Minnesota, like most states, has a Fraudulent Conveyance Act. That says if you try to convey property to a third party, and that to avoid your creditors, well, the court can set aside that transfer. So that's been applied in many situations. You know, a deed or a check or any kind of transfer, basically that is not for consideration. To an insider, and you can look at the statute for exactly when that applies. Well, his argument was, well, no, that doesn't apply because I didn't write a deed to my wife, I didn't hand her a check for this amount. This property became hers by virtue of the family court decision. The judge awarded her everything. Well, even though it was, based upon a marital termination agreement, still the family court looked at that marital termination agreement and decided that it was fair and equitable and just and so forth. So that's what she was awarded. She got the $1.2 million. He was left judgment proof. Well, the bank argued that well, that should apply the Fraudulent Transfer Act. That should apply even even though the transfer was made as part of this divorce settlement. And I forget what the Court of Appeals held, but I believe in any event, the Minnesota Supreme Court agreed with the bank and said that even though that this transfer was part of the divorce case, that does not bring it outside the ambit of the Fraudulent Transfer Act. And they went through then and applied the Fraudulent Transfer Act as they would in any other case, looked at the consideration, so forth, and held that this was indeed fraudulent as against the creditors. So like I say, kind of an interesting story. Kind of a May-September romance there that lasted 25 years. Well, another case, and during last week's call, I believe we talked about this a little bit. We kind of touched on it. But the State versus Irby case. This case relates to a Hennepin County district judge. For those of you from out of state, Hennepin County is our most populous county in the state. It's where Minneapolis is located, and it also forms its own judicial district. Hennepin and Ramsey County each constitute one judicial district. Every other county of the state is grouped in with some other county to form a judicial district. But Hennepin County, and I think it's called the 4th District, they have the same boundaries. Well, anyway, Judge Karasoff was a judge of the Hennepin County District Court. But in 2011, the Minnesota Supreme Court suspended her for two reasons. One, because she was residing outside of the district, and number two, because she did not participate fully and completely in the investigation of that underlying offense. But the main reason she was suspended was because the Minnesota Supreme Court found in 2011 that she was residing outside the district. She was no longer a resident of Hennepin County. Instead, she and her husband, I think it was her husband, had a house in Chisago County. And she spent almost seven nights a week at the property in Chisago County, and she had more or less abandoned her residence in Hennepin County. Even though she did go through the motions, she still maintained her driver's license in Hennepin County. She had an ostensible mailing address, which was a friend's apartment. And you know, if she would have done it right, I think she would have been. She would have been okay if she would have, kept an apartment and stayed there four nights a week. But that can get kind of expensive. So what she did, she paid her friend rent, but there was an understanding that she was only going to stay there on very rare occasions, basically if there was bad weather. So she was paying rent, but she didn't have any of her stuff at that address. And she wasn't residing there. So the Supreme Court held that she was no longer a resident of Hennepin County and suspended her for that reason. Well, during the pendency of the whole thing, of course, she was up on the bench holding trials, including that of Mr. Irby. And she presided over the trial of Mr. Irby, and Mr. Irby was found guilty and sent to jail for whatever. Well, he appealed to the... eventually to the Minnesota Supreme Court, and he pointed to the Minnesota statute that said, the deciding factor is not whether or not the Minnesota Supreme Court has suspended the judge, because she wasn't suspended at that point, but the statute that's linked in the materials states that the office shall become vacant upon the happening of certain events, and one of those events is that the incumbent ceases to be an inhabitant of the state, if it's a statewide office, or, quote, if the office is local, then the incumbent ceases to be a resident of the district, county, or city for which they were elected or appointed. So I quote that in detail because it says if the office is local. So he pointed to that statute and said, well, this statute clearly applies because this is a local office. She was appointed to be a judge of this district, which has the boundaries of Hennepin County. So it's a local office. She has no jurisdiction if she leaves her county. She can be appointed temporarily in some other county, as we'll see. That was actually an important factor. But he said it was a local office, and she ceased to be a resident of this county. In fact, elsewhere in the statute, it does say that the judge has to be a resident of the district where they serve. So he pointed to this statute and said that she ceased to be a judge immediately upon, and that office became vacant immediately upon her assuming residence outside of the county because the office was local. The state argued that her action should be held valid under what's called the de facto judge doctrine, which we'll talk about in a minute. That was their argument. The Supreme Court, though, kind of made an end run around the issue because they didn't want to address that issue pretty clearly. So they took a close look at this statute and said, the office shall become vacant upon the incumbent ceasing to be an inhabitant of the state. Well, no, she still lived in the state. Or if the office is local, when she ceases to be a resident of the district. So they parsed that sentence and said, well, wait a minute, this is not a local office. As a Minnesota district judge, she is an employee of the state of Minnesota. So this was not a local office. In fact, I think they cited there, or at least they're probably thinking of, there are provisions where a Hennepin County district judge can serve by appointment in Ramsey County or whatever. So it is possible for a judge to move around outside of their district, and they clearly are state employees. In fact, kind of an interesting case construing that issue of whether or not they're a state employee. I have it cited here in the materials. Eglund versus State. Judge Eglund was a district judge, and the issue came up he was a county judge back when we had county judges. But the issue in that case was whether or not he was a state employee, because it was he was suing the state because while he was on the job driving from one courthouse to another courthouse, he was struck by a snowplow. Normally if a snowplow driver is operating their snowplow negligently and they crash into your car, well, you can sue the state because the snowplow driver was a state employee. But in that case, it became an issue because they said, well, wait a minute, your sole remedy here is workers' compensation because you are also a state employee. And they addressed the issue in that case of whether he was a county employee or whether he was a state employee, and they held that he was a state employee, although they also went on to hold that, well, no, that's not what the workers' comp statute is talking about, because, yeah, that snowplow driver was also a state employee, but he worked for a different part of the state, so that you can still sue the state, even though they are technically your employer. But turning back to this case, I mean, clearly she was a state employee, and the Supreme Court based its decision pretty much on that that statute doesn't apply, 351.02, because the office is not local for purposes of that. So therefore, the vacancy did not take place automatically just because she moved to a different county. Although if she had moved to Wisconsin, well then it clearly would have taken place because she ceased to be inhabitant of the state. But she was still an inhabitant of the state, and for purposes of that statute, the court held that the office was not local. Therefore, they were able to gloss over that issue of the de facto judge doctrine. Another case that I mentioned, I think last week, or maybe we even went into a little bit more detail on it last week, is another recent case construing that same doctrine, this Iowa Farm Bureau case, a case from the Iowa Supreme Court. And it was in this case, one of the commissioners of a of a state board voted in favor of a regulation. But she was clearly no longer a resident of the state of Iowa when she did that. And under a similar Iowa statute, it said that when you cease to be a resident of the state, well, you're automatically removed from any state. You can no longer serve as a state officer. So in that case, they had to address it a little bit more clearly because she had actually moved out of the state and very unambiguously. I mean, I think I said last week, what was she thinking? Here she's voting on as an officer of the state of Iowa, yet in her pocket is her Montana driver's license. And she didn't, unlike the judge in Hennepin County, she didn't even go through the motions of pretending to maintain residency there. I wonder what was she thinking. But here, the Iowa Supreme Court was faced pretty squarely with that. And there's quite a bit of federal law on the subject of whether one stays a de facto officer, even though she was no longer qualified to hold the office she held. And as a matter of law, that office was therefore vacated. So she was not the de jure member of the state commission, but as with any state commission, they're churning out rules and adjudications and everything, and just the practical problem of saying, well, wait, this person served for so many months on this board, so is every action that took place by the board during that period of time invalid? Just makes the remedy so complicated. So they pointed to a lot of federal cases applying this de jure or de facto officer doctrine and held that that did apply in this case. Because even though she was off the board officially and not entitled to draw any payment or so forth, but still it would just be such a mess to have to sort out everything that happened. Before I forget, let me give the first code number for this part of the program. The first code number for this program is D192. D as in Delta 192. D192 is the first code word for today's program. Finally, I spent maybe a little bit more time on this issue than I did on others, but I expect we'll probably be seeing it again in the federal courts, because as you're aware, probably recently the U.S. Supreme Court held that, and I have a link to the case here, but the U.S. Supreme Court held that President Obama's many of his recess appointments to various boards were invalid because the Senate was not in fact in recess, and I would think that this issue is going to come up in that context because these various boards to which he appointed these people, and they are clearly not members of those boards, but still during that time they must have churned out thousands and thousands of pages of rulemakings and adjudications and so forth. So it seems to me this issue is just bound to come up again. And I don't recall whether they addressed that at all in this actual case. I think the holding there was simply that those appointments were invalid. I don't know if they got into what the effects were. I'm just going to really quickly just check my email here to see if I have any questions. And no, I don't see any. So we will continue on here. But like I say, the de facto official doctrine, I think we'll be seeing more of that as time goes by. Another one where, as you can see, I kind of just quoted the court syllabus here because if you're don't practice in the area of criminal law, probably not too relevant. But State versus Jones, decided on July 2nd, talking about the appropriateness of consecutive sentences for for offenses that took place as part of a single course of conduct. So this addresses the issue of whether somebody convicted of two offenses, but basically out of the same course of conduct, whether they can be sentenced consecutively, and applies those rules. Another one where I have kind of just a pretty short summary here, Lion Financial Services. I just quoted the rule here, a contract rule. This was a certified question from a case that was pending in the Seventh Circuit, a federal case from Illinois, I think, that was based under Minnesota law. But the holding here and the answer to the Seventh Circuit was that if you're suing for breach of contract and the breach is a representation of future legal compliance. So you have a contract that says, in the future, we will, when we supply these widgets to you, these widgets will be in compliance with all applicable laws. So it's a representation of future legal compliance. The question then is, does there have to be proof of reliance on that? And the Minnesota Supreme Court held no, there does not have to be any proof of reliance, basically because it's a contract claim. So in other words, they're saying that, yes, that is squarely a contract claim. You don't have to just say that it's based upon promissory estoppel or something like that, in which case there would have to be proof of reliance. No, as long as that is part of the contract claim. The next case, probably not, unless you represent pharmacies and healthcare coverage issues, the next case probably is not particularly relevant on a day-to-day basis. But in this case, a union and some other health insurance were basically suing a number of large pharmacies on the issue of generics and prescription drugs, and basically whether the pharmacy has to pass along any savings resulting from the use of generic drugs. So like I say, if you practice in the area of pharmacy law, you're probably well aware of that decision. But outside of that field, probably of relatively limited relevance. Well, with that, we turn to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And as you see down at the bottom, I have a link to some of today's decisions. And it turns out there are no reported decisions today. If we have time, we'll take a look at maybe a couple of the unreported cases that came out from the Court of Appeals today. But no reported decisions. The Minnesota Court of Appeals distributes its decisions on Mondays. And so our most recent reported decisions come from last week, July 21st. The Drews case talks about service of process. It came up in the context of a mortgage foreclosure because under the foreclosure by advertisement statute, it says that certain papers have to be served, quote, in the same manner as for a summons in a civil action. So this is really construing Rule 4 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, talking about service of a summons in a civil case. Kind of an interesting fact pattern here. This guy looks like maybe he was kind of evading service a little bit. The process server showed up many, many times to serve these papers, knocked on the door, and nobody ever came to the door. Well, he kind of staked the place out a little bit, ascertained that the guy was at home, and he looked through a window into the guy's workshop and saw the guy back there and made eye contact with him through an open window. And told him, I have some papers to serve on you. I am going to tape them to your front door. And based upon the facts that were held at trial. The trial court held that that personal service was proper in that case. Even though he did not physically hand the papers to him, he made eye contact with him. He conversed through the open window, but the guy did not come to the open window to have the papers handed in to him. So he taped them to the door. Although then when the process server came back a few hours later, I think he said they were still taped to the door. He then brought a quiet title action basically to set aside the foreclosure. And the sole issue at trial in that quiet title action was whether or not the service of process had been proper. And here the district court held, listened to the testimony of the process server and listened to the testimony of the plaintiff in the quiet title action, and held that service of process was had been effected in that case. And the Court of Appeals affirmed. Although they pointed out that the foreclosure statute has to be strictly complied with, but here they held that since that service was proper under Rule 4 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, that was adequate in this case. Moving on to the Pfeiffer case, this is a medical malpractice case. And for those of you in other states, I don't know if you have exactly the same procedure, but here in Minnesota, for many years, when you file a medical malpractice case, or really any case, I think the statute says where you're the proof of the case will depend upon expert testimony. Minnesota requires basically at the time that you file the complaint, or there's a if you're right up on the heels of the statute of limitation, there's kind of a grace period built in. But basically at the time of filing the case, you have to file an affidavit from your expert or from an expert. It doesn't have to be the same one you use at trial, I don't think. But you need an affidavit from an expert who would be competent to testify at trial, saying that that expert is you know, prepared to testify at trial that the breach of the duty of care was as follows. So in other words, in Minnesota, probably this is true in other states, you can't just file a medical malpractice case without basically having your expert testimony lined up beforehand. Well, this case construes that statute. Here there was kind of a complicated procedural posture because the case was filed and then because of a change of parties, I think they had to refile it in the name of the trustee. But in any event, the original case was dismissed without prejudice. And the plaintiffs were required to file a brand new lawsuit, and the question was whether or not the that original affidavit could be rehabilitated in the later case, because the among other things, the affidavit when it was originally filed had some flaws, and the statute says that kind of flaw you can correct in this way or that. So the question was whether that that original affidavit could be rehabilitated in this new case. So like I say, it's kind of a fact-intensive program or a fact-intensive decision, kind of an unusual fact situation. But it's a construction of that that affidavit of expert review statute. So that's the Pfeiffer case. Our next case is the Exner case, July 14th, Exner versus Minneapolis Public Schools, Special School District Number 1. I graduated from Minneapolis Public Schools, and I remember asking my sixth grade teacher, "Why is our school district special?" And she didn't know. But that's the that's the name of the school district. For some reason, every other school district in the state has the name Independent School District Number so and so. But Minneapolis is special. It's Special School District Number 1. But in any event, Mr. Exner, you know, and the I'll politicize here just a little bit. You know, in some ways I think this case was kind of wrongly decided. But boy, you know, you kind of wish they had done their homework a little bit more, because the Special School District Number 1. spends about $20,000 a year to educate each child in the Minneapolis public school system, or some outrageously large amount of money like that, and then half of them don't graduate. It seems to me so in other words, after 12 years of school, you've spent $250,000 educating these kids, and half of them don't graduate. Well, it seems to me that maybe a little bit of money is getting wasted along the way. In this case, to their credit, I guess the school district did their best to fix the problem and unwaste the money that they had wasted in this case. But they hired this gentleman to serve as the principal of one of the high schools, and he had a glowing resume, and he looked like just a great candidate for the job. He had done great things in his previous employment. Well, except looks like maybe the resume was just a little bit padded. If they had made a phone call or two to some of the names listed on that resume, it seems to me they probably would have maybe made a little bit different personnel decision. But in any event, they decided to hire him. They said the school board has to formally act upon this. Well, while it was before the school board made its formal vote to give him the job offer, they got an anonymous email pointing out that maybe some of the things in this gentleman's resume were not quite up to par. So they did a little bit of investigation and realized that maybe this anonymous email was onto something, and they changed their mind about hiring the guy. Well, they replied to him saying that the letter they sent to him that said you are being released and your employment as principal of this high school is being terminated. And they invoked the language that would have been used to fire a tenured faculty member. And the Minnesota Court of Appeals held that once they invoked that language of the Teacher Tenure Act, they were kind of stuck, and they could not argue that he was not a tenured teacher. So they had to go through all the procedures of the Minnesota Teacher Tenure Act, and tenured teachers have a lot of protection. So like I say, I mean, I give the school board credit for fighting the decision once they realized what was going on. But boy, it seems to me if they would have just been a little bit more careful in the initial hiring practices, they probably would have saved the taxpayers of Minneapolis a little bit of money, and maybe could have used some of those resources to get one more kid to graduate. So, so much for my politicizing. But the holding in that case is that the Teacher Tenure Act, once invoked, you can't, as a school board, you can't uninvoke it and say, well, no, he's not really a tenured teacher. The contract was never signed. Well, they were basically precluded from making that argument. An implied consent case. Last week, I think we had kind of an interesting case of the Minnesota implied consent statute saying that necessity is not a defense. In that case we had last week, even though that the person would have been justified in shooting somebody and had a defense to a charge of homicide, well, it was not a defense to the implied consent statute, and she still had her license taken away. But here you have to give them credit. Somebody else is up there chipping away at the implied consent statute and saying, "Well, wait a minute, this is a violation of the Constitution because I didn't consent to anything. Well, there's no such thing as implied consent." As you might have guessed, that argument has been made in various forms over the years, and has not been successful. In this case, it wasn't successful either. They Yeah, so the implied consent statute is still constitutional in Minnesota. Psychologist client privilege. And before we get to that, I guess we better give you our second code number. The second code number for today's program is D as in Delta 271. D-271. D-271 is the second code word for today's program. Psychologist client privilege. Well, as you know, there's a psychologist client privilege in Minnesota, just like the attorney client privilege or the doctor-patient privilege. And if you're a psychologist and your patient tells you things during the course of your psychological treatment, well, that information is privileged, and you can't be compelled to give that testimony. Well, here the Ramsey County District Court held that there's an exception to that privilege for the threats exception, because this guy went to his court-ordered psychologist, he was there because of, I think, was a child protection case. So he went to his psychologist as ordered by the court, and he told the psychologist, you know, I really don't like this this counselor very much. And if I had my the child protection worker. He said, you know, this child protection worker has ruined my life. You know, and if I had my way about it, I would engage in some sort of violence against her. He would break her back. Yeah, that's what he said he was going to do. He could make a couple of phone calls if he wasn't able to, and somebody else would break her back for him. So that's what he told his psychologist. The psychologist was a little bit alarmed by this, and among other things, he thought he had an ethical duty to warn. So he called up the counselor and said, "Well, you know, my court-ordered patient wants to break your back." She didn't take that too lightly, and there were some criminal charges filed, and he was charged with terroristic threats for actually saying that to his. He didn't actually break her back, but he said he was guilty of terroristic threats for saying that to his counselor. The district court ordered the counselor to testify, despite the claim of privilege, and held that there was a threats exception. And I think the rationale of that lower court's decision wasn't really spelled out, but I think what they were getting at was that there's the psychologist has a duty to warn ethically and maybe as a mandatory reporter. So therefore, if you tell your psychologist you're going to engage in violence, you really don't have an expectation of privacy because you know that your psychologist has a duty to share that information. And I think that's what they based the threat exception on. The Minnesota Court of Appeals looked at that and said, no, there's no threat exception because it doesn't say anything in the statute about a threat exception. So therefore, the psychologist cannot be compelled to testify against the guy, and really since that's the only evidence that he made these terroristic threats, that was thrown out. It was sent back for a new trial at which he will not be convicted. Let's see, more attorney's fees in a family law case comes up in the Sandvik case, court-ordered attorney fees. In a divorce case, basically here the attorney's fees were awarded, and then the two litigants, patched up most of their differences and whatever, and the attorney was kind of left alone, and the attorney fees hadn't gotten paid. This case holds that the attorney had standing to assert his claim for attorney's fees, even though his client was basically no longer a party to the case. No fault, Schroeder versus Western National Mutual Insurance Company, Minnesota. We have no fault insurance, and it lists the things that you're entitled to. You're entitled to your medical bills. You're entitled to mileage to your doctor. You're entitled to a lot of things, except not pain and suffering unless you hit the threshold. But one of the things that you are entitled to is replacement value of household services. So if you are injured in a car accident and you used to wash the dishes and make the beds, and you, because of your injury, are no longer able to do that, well, you are entitled to the reasonable value of those services. Well, in this case, the person made that claim, but the insurance company said, well, where are the receipts for the person that you hired to come in and make the beds and wash the dishes? And the plaintiff said, I don't have any receipts. I decided just to let the beds stay unmade and the dishes remain unwashed. So the insurance company denied the claim for that reason. Well, the holding in this case is that there is no requirement that you procure those replacement services. You are still entitled to the reasonable value. And I guess what's that rule called? The corollary or the collateral source rule. Basically, an application of that, because in reality, the dishes probably didn't go totally unwashed. You have friends and family help out with that stuff, even though you are not paying them money. Well, the insurance company does not benefit by the fact that your friends are washing your dishes for you. You are still entitled. Entitled to that compensation, because that's what the statute says. Basically, just a matter of statutory construction. Okay, State versus Martin. If you practice criminal law, basically, well, okay, there was a plea agreement, and then the state agreed to a stay of adjudication, but then the issue came up later. Well, this answers the question of if there is a later adjudication, what law applies? Boy, I forget what they held. Is governed by the case law that applies to the stay. So the case law as of the original date of the stay of adjudication, I guess, is what they finally held applies. So if you have stay of adjudications that rear their head later on, that would be the case to look at. Like I say, today there were not too many cases handed down by the Court of Appeals. I guess we have time. We'll just kind of look at a couple of them. No reported decisions. I guess the only two, and I didn't, I haven't even looked at all of the unreported decisions from today. Oh, I clicked on the wrong thing here. I didn't look at all the unreported decisions, but I guess the two that I saw that were kind of might be of some interest. Let's see. I think State versus Galtney was the one talking about the automobile exception to the warrant requirement. Let me make sure. Yeah, he was a felon in possession, and the weapon was found during a search of his car. So the case construes the automobile exception. And then there was another case construing the automobile exception, the one following that here, State versus Cunningham. So during the course of the week, I'll probably have summaries of those cases and maybe some of the others. There were, even though they didn't have any reported decisions today, they had 26 unreported decisions. So I didn't really get a chance to take a look at all of those. So there might be some interesting material in there. But in any event, today, July 28th, there were no reported decisions. Since we have time, I'm going to take a look at a couple of out-of-state cases, one from Iowa and one from Wisconsin. If you want to see the summaries of these cases, you can just go to the main page on my website, richardclem.com, and somewhere on there will say there'll be a link, something about summaries of recent appellate decisions. And if you find that page and scroll down to the Iowa Court of Appeals, the first one on that list will probably be, or should be, State of Iowa versus James Thielman. and it talks about exigent circumstances. So another Fourth Amendment case. Here, the Des Moines police responded to a call of a strong odor of narcotics coming from a particular apartment building. They walked into the apartment building. They could smell marijuana, and as they approached one particular apartment, the smell kept getting stronger and stronger. So they knocked on the door. And when the occupant of the apartment opened the door, there was an overwhelming odor of marijuana coming from the apartment. And the defendant, Mr. Thielman, had red, bloodshot, watery eyes, and he looked like he was under the influence of something. And on top of that, he was verbally aggressive and yelled obscenities. So I think maybe the cops were onto something here. So they just stepped in and didn't really ask for permission to enter. And in the living room, they saw a glass jar containing marijuana. They found some marijuana paraphernalia. They searched the apartment. They found people in the bedroom. Nobody claimed to be the owner of the marijuana. But anyway, he was arrested for possession of marijuana. And the only evidence of the case against him was, well, pretty solid evidence, the marijuana seized from his apartment. But he filed a motion to suppress, saying that the police officers had no reason to be in his apartment because they didn't have a warrant. And indeed, the police did not have a warrant. The court looked at this and said, well, there was indeed probable cause. So if they can come up with some exception, there's probable cause for the search, but there's no warrant. They didn't have a piece of paper signed by a judge saying they could go in there. The trial court let the marijuana come into evidence, and he was sentenced to 6 months, it looks like. He appealed to the Iowa Court of Appeals. And he once again made the argument that this should have been excluded because it was a warrantless search. Well, the state was arguing that there were exigent circumstances here, and namely not the exigent circumstances of the house burning down or some violent crime taking place inside, but the exigent circumstance was that this guy could destroy the evidence. So we can come in here and get the evidence now, but if we go down to the courthouse and get a warrant, all the marijuana will be destroyed by the time we get back with that warrant. So that's the exigent circumstance. Well, the Iowa Court of Appeals disagreed on that, and they said that no, that evidence should have been suppressed because this is not a case of exigent circumstances, because if they were indeed concerned about that. Well, first of all, when they smelled the strong odor of marijuana at the door, they didn't need to alert the guy inside. They could have at that point, posted an officer at the door and gone downtown to get the warrant and then come back with the warrant. So they didn't, there was really no need to tip the guy off. So they kind of created the exigent circumstance by knocking at the door and saying, have you been smoking marijuana? So there, they held that there was no exigent circumstance. And interestingly, they look at one of the issues that they look at, and they cite some U.S. Supreme Court cases on this issue, and that is, is it really exigent circumstances? Doesn't that depend on the severity of the crime? If somebody is going to be destroying some evidence in a very, very serious crime, well, that's probably more exigent than, he's going to destroy evidence in possession of marijuana. Although, apparently, possession of marijuana, apparently for his own use, was resulted in a six-month sentence in Iowa. So kind of an interesting look at exigent circumstances coming from Iowa. And then our last case, I guess, we'll talk about, and before I do that, I'll give you our third code number. And our third code number is D 305. D is in Delta 305. D305 is the third code number for today's program. The last case we're going to look at, again, if you go to my case summary page and scroll down to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, you will find the Board of Regents of the University of Wisconsin versus Decker. And Mr. Decker looks like was kind of a troublemaker. He didn't like the fact he thought the student fees were too high. So he complained every chance he got, and he wasn't quite so artful in his complaints, I guess, and he went into the chancellor's office and started messing with papers at the chancellor's desk, and he went and disrupted Board of Regents meetings and went and disrupted other meetings. Just kind of caused a lot of havoc around the various. He traveled throughout the state. Apparently, he was suspended at Stevens Point, and he went to a Regents meeting in Madison, and he went to a after being suspended, he went to a basketball game at Oshkosh, even though the rules say that once you're suspended, you're supposed to stay off campus entirely. So finally the Board of Regents had enough, and they went to court and they got a harassment restraining order. And Minnesota has harassment restraining orders. It looks like the Wisconsin statute is pretty similar. And if somebody is harassing you, you can go get a harassment restraining order. That's what the Board of Regents did. So the first issue was, had he engaged in harassment under this statute? And the second issue does the Board of Regents have standing to get one of these harassment restraining orders? Because when you read the statute, both Minnesota and Wisconsin, it kind of presupposes that the plaintiff or petitioner or whatever it's called in the case is a natural person. But the court first held that an institution such as the University of Wisconsin is a proper plaintiff, and they have standing to get one of these petitions. But then the other issue was, had he engaged in harassment? Because they looked at the statute, and the statute said, you do all this stuff, and it defined harassment. But one of the elements is that the activities that you engage in serve no legitimate purpose. Well, the circuit court in Dane County said that, this is clearly harassment. But the Court of Appeals reversed that because they said, there was some legitimate purpose to his conduct, because even though he wasn't doing a particularly good job of doing this, he did have some grievances about these student fees. So even though, what he was doing really amounts to harassment, he did kind of have a legitimate purpose, especially when you read it in light with the First Amendment, because, that's an area you have to watch out for, because we do have the right to free speech, and we have the right to petition for redress of our grievances. So this statute, to the extent that it interfaces with that, you have to be pretty careful. And the Court of Appeals reversed and held that this was not a proper case for a harassment restraining order because he did kind of have a legitimate purpose in doing all this, even though he wasn't doing a very good job of it. After addressing that other issue of standing, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reversed and said, we have to be careful about it, but when you go in and disrupt meetings and mess with papers on somebody's desk, you have to be careful. And yes, this is basically a time, place, and manner restriction. So the harassment restraining order, even though it's interfering with his free speech, it basically amounts to a time, place, and manner restriction, and for that purpose is appropriate. With that, I see we're up to an hour here. So first of all, I'm just going to check my email real quick to see if I have any last minute questions. Let's see. It looks like I have people sending in the code numbers. So it looks like somebody has a question about ethics and bias. So I'll answer that offline. But I will. let's see if I can find it on my computer here. First of all, I'll unmute. So if I will open it up for questions. And before I do that, I will give the final code number. And the final code number for today's program is D449. D as in Delta 449. D449 is the last code word. So with that, I will open it up again for questions. And hearing none, thank you all for joining me.